had the unique opportunity to be able to be with my nephew when he saw a space shuttle for the first time in real life. And so space holds a very special place in my heart, as I think it does in many of yours. And so I think it's very exciting to be here today to discuss the role that the space community may play in the development community as well. And so today, I want to take us through a quick discussion of the world of development, the recent progress that we've made, and the challenges that we face ahead, as well as the role that the space community might play, and two opportunities that I think are especially salient. So I come first with some good news. Worldwide, things are looking up. If we look back at the Millennium Development Goals, we can see that over the past 15 years, a lot has improved. For instance, extreme poverty rate, measured as those living on less than $1.25 per day, has gone from 47% in developing countries down to 14%. At the same time, people aren't just earning more money, but they're living healthier lives as vaccine coverage continues to increase and has jumped 10 percentage points in the last 15 years. And as well, people aren't just making more money and they're not just healthier, but they're actually improving the educational opportunities for their children. If you lived in sub-Saharan Africa in 1990 and you were a child of primary school age, you only had half a chance of being able to attend school. Whereas in 2015, 8 out of 10 children in sub-Saharan Africa are now enrolled in school. But at the same time, alongside these advances in well-being, there's an increasing awareness that although things have improved, there are still many problems that don't yet have solutions. And additionally, there are many things that we thought were solutions that haven't actually solved any problems whatsoever. And so there's been a recent reckoning in the development world that the progress that we've made has largely been on first order issues, and at the same time, it hasn't been applied equally. So if we think back to our education example, while getting kids enrolled in school is a laudable and important outcome, it isn't necessarily in and of itself something that will improve the lifelong outcomes for a child. And so instead, as the Sustainable Development Goals make clear, there's been an increasing awareness and a shifting in objectives towards things that actually specifically imply important lifelong outcomes and at the same time apply them equitably across the board. So if we think about those 20% of children who are still not enrolled in schools in sub-Saharan Africa today, those in many ways are going to be the most difficult to reach. They're among the most marginalized. They may be far away from schools at the moment. They may be girls. They may be orphans. They may be those who were first forced to work. And in many ways, those 20% are actually going to be much more difficult to reach than the 80% who are already enrolled in school. So let's put ourselves in the shoes of a minister of education, or a principal, or a school teacher, or even a primary school student, and think about what would be the best way to improve student learning. Now, some would say that we need to think about the basics, and we need to build more schools, we need to provide uniforms for children who are required to wear them to go to school, and we need to provide textbooks so that they can actually learn. Others would say we can actually leapfrog a lot of those things by implementing new technology. We can put computers in schools instead, or provide telelearning in places where it doesn't already exist. Others say, well, no. What we need is actually a change in pedagogy, and we need to think about new curriculums. We need to think about training teachers differently. We need to think about teaching children by their achievement level rather than by their age. And others still say, well, it doesn't really have anything at all to do with education, and it's a matter of incentives. And so what we need to do is properly incentivize teachers to teach, or perhaps properly incentivize students to learn with scholarships or something of the sort. So take a look at this list and think to yourself, what do you think, if you had to choose just one, is the best way to improve student learning? Now, because this is a science conference, I want to make this a bit more interactive. So I'm going to ask for your help in something. If you think that the basics are the answer, when I say blast off, I want you to snap your fingers. If you think that new technology is the best way, I want you to whistle. If you think we need a change in pedagogy, I want you to clap your hands. And if you think that motivation is what we need, I want you to bang your feet on the ground. 3, 2, 1, blast off. Great, thank you. So as you just heard throughout the room, there was an incredible amount of discord. I'm not sure who won. There were also people who chose not to participate. And these types of activities and this type of communication is an amount of discord that often exists in the development community as well, where people have very strong opinions based on very different things. Anecdotes, something they might have heard, quantitative data, qualitative data, information that they've seen when they were working in the field. And it turns out that to meet a lot of these evolving development challenges and to think critically about getting deeper into some of the issues we face today, it can be very useful to bring objective information to the table to allow decision makers to make a clear opinion. And that's something that my organization works on and strives to do when thinking about these evolving challenges. So continuing our example, the four columns that you see here are different education projects that were implemented in different countries. On the far left, you have a remedial education program in India, then an individually paced computer-assisted learning program, a read-a-thon where children took home books and were motivated to be able to read on their own, and then the one laptop per child program. Now, as you can see here, with the y-axis being student learning measured in standard deviations of test achievement, there is a wide degree of variation among these programs. And the answers that I, or the options that I put before you in the previous slide aren't necessarily as clean as they think. Because although a computer proved to be very useful when it was used for individually paced assisted learning, it didn't actually turn out to be as useful for learning outcomes in and of themselves when implemented as a one laptop per child program, which I'll also mention started at MIT. And if we gave this information to a policymaker, even then, the policymaker wouldn't necessarily be able to make the best decision. Because as in the space community, in the development community, we're also faced with limited resources. And we need to think exactly how far our money can go when thinking about the effectiveness of a program. So if we took those same four programs and looked at what a $100 investment would get us in terms of student learning outcomes, we see that the table shifts slightly. And remedial education actually has twice the effect as the individually paced computer-assisted learning program. And it's this sort of evidence that combines both new and exciting technology and innovation with rigorous analysis that really allows policymakers to be able to understand what we need to do to meet the challenges of today. So how exactly do we run these evaluations, and how do we get this information? Well, while there are many different types of impact analysis, J-PAL focuses on randomized control trials, which are seen to be the gold standard of analysis. You might have heard of them before from the medical field or from clinical drug trials, and we run similar evaluations on the ground. So in thinking about our education example, let's say that a minister of education was going to implement a computer program in a rural country, or in a rural area of Uganda, and they had a select set of villages. What they would do to be fair and equitable to the population there is they're thinking about, with their limited resources, what they can possibly implement, where they would run a lottery to be able to divide half of the population into those who would be the first to receive this sort of computer program, and divide half the population and the other half as a comparison group. Now, with a large population, these groups, because they had an equal amount of chance to be divided into the group that received the computer program or the group that did not, are going to be equal in all other ways on average. And so, after a semester or a year, or perhaps even upon graduation of these students from primary school, we can measure different outcomes. And because the two groups continue to be identical, except for the intervention, we know that any differences in those outcomes are attributed specifically to the program. And it's not just in Africa or in education that this sort of rigorous analysis can take place, but all over the world. So our network of affiliated professors has 770 ongoing and completed projects in over 70 countries. Unfortunately, Austria has not yet made the list, so if you're interested, come talk to me. And it's these sorts of evaluations that are really the way that in which we can match rigorous evidence to the evolving development challenges that we face today. And so far, I've been discussing a lot about development, and it may be the case that the organizers of this conference are starting to whisper to themselves, is he ever going to talk about space? Well, the truth is, we're all here today because we actually have identified the fact that there is overlap between these two communities and the goals that we hope to achieve, and as well, there are more opportunities for that in the future. And this sort of overlap is especially salient to me because it's the same sort of overlap that we at J-PAL at MIT strive to identify. So we run rigorous evaluations, we disseminate evidence through policy outreach, and we also build the capacity of policymakers to be able to both generate evidence on their own and also engage with the evidence to be able to make decisions accordingly. And at J-PAL, we not only think about overlap, but we also think about our comparative advantage to be able to contribute something to this space. And so in thinking about the comparative advantage that the space community has as well in this space, there are two things that I want to highlight for you today that I see as main opportunities. The first is institutionalizing overlap. Now, we've come a long way since Sputnik, and space technology is a part of our lives every single day, whether it's the food that we eat or the phone that we use. And it makes sense. There are a lot of different ways in which that which we learn in space has a role on Earth. So, for instance, the European Space Agency has 7 business incubation centers set up to support 60 startups every year that make sure that space technology has a place on Earth. NASA has over 1,000 products available for licensing and has amassed a database of nearly 2,000 different innovations that are available as well. And there are specific charters set up, like the International Charter on Space and Major Disasters, that make satellite imagery available when disaster strikes. And of course, it makes sense that these sorts of things exist, because oftentimes, the space community is focused on innovating in places that are among the most resource scarce and extreme in the entire universe. And the development community is likewise focused on places that are the most resource scarce and extreme places on Earth. So to give you a real life example of this, I was recently in Sierra Leone during the Ebola outbreak to do some exploratory work to try to better understand how to increase immunization rates there. Now, Sierra Leone ranks 4th from last on the United Nations Human Development Index. And the life expectancy there is 43 years old, the worst in the world. Less than 10% of the population has access to electricity. So historically, what would have to happen is a family would go from their village to a city center to be able to receive vaccinations for their children. But since 1999, following a NASA spinoff, they've instead implemented and distributed throughout the country battery-free, solar-powered, heavily insulated refrigerators. And motorcycling nurses will travel to village centers or to cities to be able to gather vaccines and take them back to health clinics where they're more readily available to families and store them there for as long as they'll last. But although this is an incredible innovation in and of itself, similar to the student learning example that we walked through, it isn't necessarily the end goal. Because while I was there, I learned something else. First, the technology isn't everywhere. Only 40% of health clinics actually have this refrigerator in place. At the same time, of those 40%, only 30% were working. And of those 30%, 10% of them, 10% of them also didn't have any power, so it's unclear what the actual issue was along the way. And NASA has been innovating for years, and it's been testing innovations and continuing to tweak and hone its analysis alongside that. And it continues to be able to make their analysis more efficient and effective than ever. So in the economics world, we benefit enormously from this, because we spend most of our time scratching at chalkboards or running around with clipboards. But the research tools that the space technology community and others have developed have proved immensely useful. So this photo on the right is a photo of my colleague's Toyota RAV4 filled nearly to the brim with surveys. When I was in Uganda conducting a research project 10 years ago, we conducted all of our research using paper. And for this project specifically, we distributed 2,500 surveys, 20-page surveys, to 250 locations across the country. And this represents one small portion of one of those survey rounds. And we conducted another survey round 9 months later. Now, today, things look very, very different. When I was back in Uganda to conduct a research project in 2014, instead of printing out 50,000 pages, instead, we charged 50 smartphones for surveyors to be able to take out to the field with satellite linkages to be able to upload the surveys immediately and GPS technology to be able to actually tag the location where each and every one of those surveys took place. And it's not just survey tools that actually have overlap with the space community, but also innovative policy in and of itself. A recent evaluation by a JPL affiliate took advantage of space technology in a way that we wouldn't even have thought of 10 or 20 years ago. So you're about to hear a lot about climate change from Jennifer Frankel Reed at USAID, and I don't pretend to know anywhere near what she knows about climate change. But the two images that you see here represent a unique use of space technology combined with on-the-ground rigorous evaluation. So JPL affiliate SEMA went and partnered with the Ugandan Forest Authority to not just map out tree coverage throughout rural Uganda, but to run an evaluation to test the effectiveness of a payment for ecosystem services program, in which farmers were paid a small amount of money not to cut down the forest that was on their land. Now, in order for a program like this to work, one has to actually be sure that the forest stays there. And what became increasingly evident is that it would be impossible to do this on the ground because it was both difficult to actually spot trees and count trees, and even if that were to be possible, it would be too expensive. So instead, what the Forest Authority did is they commissioned a commercial satellite to fly over once before the program was implemented and randomly offered to some farmers in the area, and then again after the program to see what had changed in the meantime. And what they found was that the program was effective, and farmers who were randomly selected to receive payments for not cutting down trees on their land reduced the amount of trees that they cut down to the tune of about half as many. And this policy, or this technology, is something that is not only a part of this research project, but something that is a necessary component of what could be a policy that scaled up to all of Uganda or all of any other country in the world. And this is incredibly important for Uganda itself because it has the third highest deforestation rates of any country in the world. And it's not just tools for better research or innovative policy analysis that can be shared across the two communities, but also research methodology in and of itself. Economists didn't invent randomized evaluations. Depending on who you speak to, it was either a potato farmer trying to grow more potatoes, or a doctor in the late 1700s who was trying to figure out how to treat scurvy with sailors. And it was widely adopted and used widespread in the medical community long before it was adopted in the economics community. And in the same way, space community continues to innovate on its research methodologies. So in 2000, NASA commissioned a grant to an MIT aeronautics professor to create an algorithm to conduct cost-effectiveness analyses similar to the one which I showed you earlier on student learning. So if it's possible to be able to learn something from this sort of algorithm and apply it to the same way to the analyses that those in the economics field are doing, I think we can have a much more constructive, more efficient, and ultimately more accurate and beneficial cost-effectiveness analyses methodology than we do today. Now, because I'm an economist and you all are researchers or implementers and government officials, I wanted to end today with a talk about money for a moment. Now, the two charts that you see here are the amount of space spending in 2015 and the amount spent on development in 2015. And the space community spending amounted to about $330 billion, and development was $130 billion. And I show you these two charts not to show you that one is bigger than the other or to discuss how expenditures should be allocated between the two communities, but to say that these two charts don't need to live in parallel worlds. And there's significant overlap that can happen between the two to not just save money between the two, but to ultimately make sure that we're both doing a better job of achieving the type of goals that we want to achieve. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak today, and I look forward to the conversations to come.